Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be having the second in a kind of informal series of programs that we are doing, trying to look at international issues that are important in this year's presidential contest. And certainly, I think we'd have to say that if you look at the foreign policy challenges for the United States today, that Iraq and Iran are at the top of the list, certainly high on the list. And we can expect that whoever the next president of the United States is, that Iran and Iraq will continue to be important foreign policy challenges, along with Pakistan and Afghanistan and the rest of the Middle East and West Asia, for that matter. We thought that we would try to talk a little bit about these challenges posed by this region this morning, and we have two guests with us. Colin Flint, he is Associate Professor of Geography here at the University of Illinois. He is a political geographer, and Behrouz Ghamari is Assistant Professor of History and Sociology, both of them very much interested in modern politics of the Middle East, and pleased that they could be here. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much for being
here.
We appreciate it. There, obviously, the subject area here is very large. Maybe as a way of starting out to talk a little bit about Iraq, I think now it is true that probably for most people, no matter whether they thought it was a good idea or not, that the thing that they're thinking about is getting the American troops home. How and when that will be accomplished, that's the issue. I guess, though, I wonder whether in focusing so much on the withdrawal, how and when, if that is in fact the most important issue, and whether we're maybe missing something by spending so much time talking about let's get the troops home.
Well, perhaps the thing that should be discussed is what are the implications if they were to leave. Mm-hmm. And that may temper people's calculations as to whether this should be done, how much and how quickly. And this is, I think, a very difficult issue to address. I think it's especially difficult for people to address who opposed the war and believed it to be an unjust war and a strategic mistake. And now, all these years later, one has to consider what difficulties would emerge, what carnage could result if there was withdrawal. And so I think to wrestle with those moral dilemmas, perhaps the question of implications of withdrawal, what would, could happen, the probabilities of different scenarios should really be discussed.
Mm-hmm. I think that as was the case before the invasion of Iraq, this is primarily a political question. And the future of Iraq really is not going to be drawn on the military table. And this is what has been one of the most important issues that was not addressed before, after, during the war. And even as we talk today, the way the debate is framed still is around this kind of military question of withdrawal, not withdrawal, and how many troops do we need, how many soldiers can we have on the ground in the bases, and so on and so forth. But seldom we hear discussion, very substantive discussion about political solutions and what possibilities are there for different factions in Iraq to form a united government. Mm-hmm. And that debate is not really has not even started.
Well, do you think, and I think as you say, that this is perhaps most difficult for people who have all along opposed the war and thought that it was a bad idea, but that the reality is that the United States will have to continue to be, if we're interested in political stability in the region, the United States is going to continue to have to be involved. That may mean that American soldiers, well, some numbers of them might still have to be there. And that involvement, as some people would say, could mean a commitment of another, who knows, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years?
40 years, 50 years.
10 years, 20. Well, that's, yeah, I mean, truly no one knows. And that, you know, to err on the side of a long period of time rather than a short period of time probably makes more sense. I mean, that's a real difficult thing, I think, for a lot of people to think about.
I think it would be very hard for either administration, whatever administration is, a McCain administration or an Obama administration, to have removed troops, even to a significant degree, within the next 4 years. And I think that that's probably a hard thing for some people to hear or to take. I think it would be very hard, even with all the will in the world, for the whoever is president after these elections. I think that we are, there will be U.S. troops in Iraq for over the next administration for sure.
And that, I think that's minimum.
That's minimum. That that's is minimum. Yes, yes. Yeah. I mean that.
Because,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of course, because you know, with the amount of investment that is going on now in building permanent bases in Iraq. No administration is going to say that, okay, forget about those bases that are being built as we speak. So the American presence in Iraq is going to be a very long-term presence. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt about that. But in terms of, as Colin says, in terms of actual combat engagement, that's a different story. But but American presence in Iraq is going to be a very, very long-term presence. Militarily.
I think, you know, I'm sure that there are some people who would say, well, what we simply ought to do is withdraw the troops as quickly as possible and then say to the people of Iraq, okay, good luck. You're on your own now, and trust that they manage to work things out so that they have a functioning government and society. Mm-hmm. Now, if one says, well, we really can't do that, in what way do you think the United States can, in a constructive way, try to promote the movement in Iraq towards a functioning society with a functioning government? And, you know, what have we done so far? It doesn't seem if we have been trying to do that, you have to ask some questions about just how successful it's been.
No, I think that this is actually an important question to think about, because what the future of Iraq depends on is more regional rather than just focus on Iraq. And that's where the U.S. Primarily is failing in terms of bringing together a regional coalition and beginning a discussion about how different players in the region, from the Saudis to Iranians, to the Turks, because they have a stake in the Kurdish issue. And so the answer to that question really is not something that would be worked out between the U.S. and Iraq. Rather, this is a question that should be worked out in a regional conference with all the actors involved in this issue.
I agree with that. Bruce has pointed out the regional, the international imperative here. Another issue of what needs to be done, or is some understanding of the potential for the fracture of Iraq, and I think that this was completely misunderstood, not even addressed, even despite warnings from the outset of the war, and it's still a very real possibility. What has happened over the last few years is de facto or actual, with the carnage, ethnic cleansing, and the quote unquote success of the surge, and that's a dubious claim, certainly given the amount of deaths that still occur in the country, but the notion of a success of the surge has been based upon the fact that what has happened over time is a move at neighborhood and city and regional levels to more distinct Shiite, Sunni, Turkmen, Kurd districts, which to me is a forewarning of a fracture of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite again. I mean, that's a quite important issue to think about, and also to understand that the surge actually was a political project rather than a military project. And this is the part that in the presidential debates often is sort of muddied, because the reason that we see the drop in the level of violence was not because we were militarily successful. Basically, what the U.S. government did was to hire all those insurgents to be on the payroll of American military. So in a sense, that was a political solution. It was not really a military success. And just last week, they decided to relinquish the command structure of these 120,000 Sunni resurgents into the command of the Iraqi government. And then actually in the next couple of months, we'll see how that one would work out to have this very large army of Sunni insurgents under the command of a Shiite government. But that was really a political move. Yesterday's terrorists became employees of the military, and that was really the reason behind the drop in violence, not as at times that McCain claims that it was a military success.
And so the question is there any progress in an overarching political solution which will mean that such armed groups are going to work together in a national united administration, or is this again the groundwork for potential conflicts down the road?
We have two guests here in the studio, both professors here at the University of Illinois. Colin Flint, he is a political geographer. He's professor of geography here at the U of I. Behruz Ghamari is assistant professor of history and sociology, both of them interested in and spent a lot of time following the politics of the region that we're talking about, the Middle East and West Asia. Questions are welcome. We have a caller here ready to go to bring them into the conversation. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Caller here on our toll-free line in Farina, I'm not sure which. Go ahead, line four.
Yeah, I like the Farina. Anyway, thanks for the interesting program.
Sure.
I think that both your guests have said good things and interesting things, and I think generally in the media there needs to be a paradigm shift in the conversation. We are not at war with Iraq. It's an occupation. It is not a war. It's an occupation. And I can think of ways to think of this that, like, for instance, if there was an Iraqi group of soldiers sitting in a Humvee in my street right outside my house, it would not be acceptable. It just plane would not be acceptable to have Iraqi soldiers patrolling in heavy vehicles up and down in front of my house. Okay. Now, my thought on the subject is reinstate with massive amounts of defunding the U.S. military budget, reinstate a massive Peace Corps that has a distinctive shirt or uniform or helmet, even where, like the medic in a war zone, is known by all sides to be a non-combatant, and you know, maybe just a T-shirt, but make it a Peace Corps initiative on a massive scale to help rebuild the countries that not just Iraq, not just the Middle East, every suffering country and fund it with a defunding of the bloated, overpriced, and almost useless over-militarization of the Defense Department. And it sounds all lefty, but the political solution is the solution, and with help for the people instead of intimidation. And that's all I can say quickly. Thanks. The program Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, what do you think about that idea, or at least the idea of could, rather than a military occupation, could this become a peacekeeping operation? Even, you know, I would still like to have my peacekeepers armed so they could defend themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's something other than an operation that is clearly, by anybody's definition, a military occupation.
There's a very good comment by the caller. Occupation, yes, it is an occupation. It was an invasion, and there was an occupation. I think these are very important things for us to realize. It's much easier to see this as something much more benevolent from this position in these shores, but it's an invasion and a resultant occupation. But apparently, so we're told, or have been told over the last number of years, this is an occupation as a result of a war. The war on terror, and so there's this combination or this mm-hmm. mixture of political rhetoric here that fudges this. The piece, I used the caller's term, core, he used, is interesting, and I think the use of that word core is interesting because there's a struggle here. We often think of these types of forces as peacekeeping forces that can go into a situation that is potentially volatile, perhaps has been conflictual, and keep the peace. What is very much harder is peacemaking forces, and I think we're in a situation here where I don't think we're more leaning towards the peacemaking rather than the peacekeeping. That then becomes much more problematic because implied in the caller's conversation or comments is that this should not purely be a U.S. project. To be effective, it would be a multinational project. Mm-hmm. That way, it would be less of a single country occupying your streets. It would be seen as maybe a UN-led or I don't know who else it would be, organization that is somehow more benevolent. Frankly, right now, there's no evidence that that is possible because we've seen this in Afghanistan, where there's very minimal commitment from U.S. allies to partake in these projects. The participation, the coalition of the willing in Iraq was very select, small, and big players did not take a role. And I just wonder, I believe that the United States no longer, at this moment in time, does not have the moral leadership or authority to be able to put together such a peacekeeping mm-hmm. / peacemaking force in Iraq.
That's true. I mean, the basic question, as Colin mentioned, mm-hmm. is how to reach that point mm-hmm. that we have a peacekeeping mission. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, by definition, peacekeeping means that there is a peace mm-hmm. which needs to be maintained. And so there is no peace to be maintained. And that's the entire problem is right there, that how do we get to that point? Mm-hmm. And of course, again, I appreciate the caller's insistence on you know, issues of what we call the military-industrial complex, and that's of course this is another issue, and this is an underlying issue that we need mm-hmm. to deal with in our foreign policy, in our domestic policy, in the way we decide about our budget in this country, and who gets what part of this big pie, and there's constant struggle over who gets what in the budget. And as the old saying goes, that a missile belt is a missile use, and so the moment that we have the budget to build all these weaponry, then obviously the question becomes, what are the places we can use them? These mm-hmm. are like. So in that sense, there is a broader question in which we need to understand the question of the war in Iraq. And I agree that we are not at war with Iraq. This is an occupation and a war of conquest, basically. But yes, it's true. We need to address those problems. But those problems are rather outside the frame of this program but it is true. I think I appreciate the caller's emphasis on that.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just
one of the dimensions of the so-called success of the surge is not commented on, and I've heard pundits who I thought should know better that money was actually paid to solder, not just buying off the Sunnis, awakening. There actually was a fairly big amount of money, and there are also have been some negotiations, and it's rarely commented on. It seems to me that if the U.S. really just wanted to go after Iraq, that Sadr as a sort of a more native Arab Sunni Shia leader would have been sort of pivotal. But my speculation is that when this whole thing, Afghanistan, Iraq, it was thought of by the people that, by Rumsfeld et al., as a trifecta, that after Iraq was settled, Iran would next be on the agenda. And evidence is that this going ahead, and this is also involves a large amount of money, and it's not much commented on the U.S. press, that there was a secret finding that was agreed to by the Democrats to escalate the covert war that's going on against Iran. Now, it's clearly not an occupation of Iran. It is a war. It's being done through third parties and various factions and various ethnic groups, various regional and other identified areas. I mean, when we can have the PKK and PJAC, you know, collaborating brothers in arms, but one of them is bad and the other is good. I mean, and it just, it's amazing that we can have the two candidates argue about attacking covertly into Pakistan, and there, I hope you heard the quotes on my covertly, that they can't agree not to say anything about what's going on with Iran. It's the paucity of the discourse is stunning, it seems to me. Now, I've laid a whole lot out there, and I'll hang on and listen. I appreciate any attention that you give to these points.
Yeah, I mean, these are important points again because, as I mentioned earlier, the solution to Iraqi situation is a regional one, and obviously Iran is a major player in this. And as the caller mentioned, the another part of the success of the surge was a negotiated agreement. Some with money, some with political promises, with the Shiite resistance in Iraq. And we still don't know what would the outcome of that be. And but it's true, and I think that the question of Iran, I assume at some point we are going to move to Iran,
yes.
But it's true that as Seymour Hersh, in a couple of pieces he wrote for The New Yorker mentions, and a number of other people have mentioned, that we or the U.S. government already is engaged in, at some level, in some covert operations against the Iranian government, and there are different plans to destabilize the country. They work with a number of Kurdish groups, and there are some tensions in Azerbaijan, which is northwest province in Iran, and in Balochistan there are basically these Sunni terrorist groups that are either funded or have connections with the Pakistani intelligence services and the CIA. So there are all these different elements that, again, would bring us back to this question of whether or not it's possible to come up with a solution in Iraq without dealing directly with all these different varieties of political issues in the region, in Iran, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Saudi Arabia, and in Turkey.
I'd just very briefly add that I think it's very right to point out and demand, I think, from our politicians and our media that these things are continually covered. This kind of head bones connected to the neck bone sort of political military relationships, which has just diffused this conflict and make it more and more complicated. Who are we arming and why, and what is going to be the implications for that? These are things that as the caller rightly points out, are just not addressed by politicians on either side. I think that the other thing you point out, which I think was interesting, was the sort of the attack Pakistan rhetoric, that both candidates seem to feel the need to use in this political context, and I find that very troublesome. That if you there's a perception here that if one is going to run for the White House and do it successfully, one has to use extremely aggressive language, and I just wonder what that means for the United States society and United States in the world.
I'm obviously concerned about that as well, and the point you make about blowback, or that that I pull from your comments, is that, you know, arming all of these people on the periphery of Iran and inside of Iran, you know, what are the going to be the long-term consequences of that to the entire region and the society? It may have a, you know, a realpolitik, and like I say, both the Democrats and Republican leadership signed off on this secret finding. Andrew Coburn is the writer that's associated with its release in the British press, but not much has been made of it here. And I can't get over how they're saying, well, you shouldn't telegraph your, you shouldn't talk about your covert action. And we all know that the Predator attacks aren't covert already, but the covert action that is covert that could not, you know, it's quite boggling, and it's quite frightening. I think that, like I say, I think that the intention was that it was going to be a trifecta, and I'm just as leaving a fait accompli on the stage. That's kind of what Iraq is, and I'll say this about Obama's plan. If people really look at it, it's not a withdrawal. It's he plans on leaving 50,000 troops. And now they're supposedly training and force protection, et cetera, et cetera. But that is not a withdrawal. And I you know, to some extent, Iraq is being punted into the next presidency. There are a lot of things that are liable to explode. And the status of forces agreement is one of them, because they haven't gotten any headway on that. In December, it'll go to the UN for renewal if no status of forces is agreed, and China and Russia are likely to veto it, and then we'll be it'll be not only an occupation, but a de jure illegal occupation, which I think it can be argued it is already, but it won't even have the cover of UN authorization. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We are at a midpoint here, a little bit past. We have two guests, Colin Flint. He's Associate Professor of Geography, and Behrouz Ghamari. He is Assistant Professor of History and Sociology, both from the U of I. And we're talking about the Middle East, West Asia. Fairly specifically, we've been talking about Iraq. We do want to talk about Iran. That's a particular interest of Professor Ghamari's. Though we do have another caller here, so I wanted to get them into the conversation. By the way, others are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is a caller in Belgium, the community of Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I'd like to take a slight turn on this just a little bit and question the guest as to whether this is really something we need to worry about at this point. And don't misunderstand me. The idea of war is very worrisome to me, but with today's conditions in the financial aspects, could this actually become a war that nobody can afford and will finally just quit it? Because this is essentially the prime pusher for this whole subprime thing, too, is because we've sucked so much money out of the economy of the world to finance this war that we've caused economic problems throughout the world.
Well, that's an interesting question. Will the point come when we just say, well, we're going to have to stop because we just can't afford it anymore?
Well, wars are often financed in from debt, but there does come a time when the chips have to be called in. I would take a broader picture and think about other countries. Britain, of course, from my background, comes to mind, who were bankrupted by war, wars they could not afford, and there was a transfer of global power in that context. Mm-hmm. It's a big picture, and I like big picture mm-hmm. questions. They're hard to answer specifically, yeah. but they're well worth thinking about.
Yeah. No, but again, economic crises can work both ways, and as we know from history, that there are many, many, many different wars mm-hmm. began and were continued because of this bankruptcy of their mm-hmm. economies. And mm-hmm. and war often actually is a response to economic crises. And because, again, the wars can have this effect of, I mean, to be cynical about it, is that the wars also create jobs, and because then you have a military industry that that produces these things mm-hmm. to be used, and also and we have experienced this, you know, like the experience of First World War, the experience of Second World War. They all come in the midst of this very significant and deep economic crisis, and mm-hmm. And I don't see any reason necessarily. I mean, you might be right. That the war basically becomes unaffordable to continue, but at the same time, it might work the other way as well. It might give another incentive to continue the war because it both politically might create a divergence from economic crisis, and also economically it might give rise to new forms of industry and so on and so forth.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, I do indeed want to talk some more about Iran, and we've certainly touched on that. And as Professor Garmire said, and I'm sure that other people would agree, that if we're interested in not just the long-term stability of Iraq, but stability of the whole region, all of the governments of the region are going to have to be involved in figuring out how this works. Mm-hmm. And this is complicated here by the fact that the United States and Iran don't have normal relations and haven't for, I don't know, some going on 30 years probably.
Yeah.
And that particularly over the last few years, the rhetoric between both sides has been rarely intense and negative. And as the previous caller suggests, the United States has been involved in covertly in trying to destabilize the government of Iran. So, you know, that makes one wonder, well, here we are going to have a new administration and there would be the opportunity of taking some kind of a different direction. But one wonders, even if we have a democratic administration, given where, you know, given history up to this point, how much opportunity there is, in fact, to do something really different. I mean, you know, you can't wipe the slate clean, you know. So with the next administration, well, how do we even start?
I mean, we might be actually surprised to learn that the problem between Iran and the U.S. is not a serious problem. If you just go through the questions and problems that the two sides have with one another, you realize that there aren't really issues that are completely irresolvable. And the only issue nowadays that everybody talks about is the question of Iranian nuclear technology, of course. But if we look at the actual state of things in terms of Iranian nuclear technology and in terms of where they are, what their intentions are, and what their agreements are with the United Nations IAEA, and the way Iranians actually allowed all these inspections to happen, we realize that this is rather a manufactured crisis. And, I mean, one cannot say the same thing, let's say, about Palestinian and Israelis, that is a manufactured crisis, because there are indeed very, very important issues to be resolved. But between Iran and the U.S., there aren't issues that are very difficult to figure out. And Iranians had shown their willingness to be very open about their nuclear technology. And according to IAEA's own documents, they have conducted the most intrusive inspections of any other country in Iran. And the Iranians, for the most part, they're very, very cooperative. And of course, they want to maintain a symbolic position of a power in the region. So they can't come out and openly say that, okay, we say yes to whatever you ask us to do. But in practice, actually, this is what they're doing. And the U.S., of course, I mean, and I say it's a manufactured crisis because both sides utilize this crisis for domestic consumption. And in the U.S., we know that this is utilized for another sort of effective rhetoric of war and more defense spending. In Iran, of course, it's used to suppress dissent inside the country, and anybody who says anything, immediately they're labeled as the spies of the U.S. Of course, they say that if the U.S. Congress is spending $75 million a year, and this is a fact that actually our Congress approved $75 million for promotion of democracy in Iran, then it's going to be very hard for Iranian dissidents to do any kind of anti-government or reform activities without being labeled as the spies of the United States. So in that sense, I think, you know, it's a this is a manufactured crisis, and both sides are taking political advantage of this crisis. But at the moment they sit around the table and start negotiation, I'm 100% sure that they find a lot of common interests between the two sides, and the only issue here is for the U.S. to decide to come to terms actually with this issue that Iran has emerged already as a regional power, and we need to come to terms with that and recognize that.
I sorry agree with Behrouz's comments and his insight. I just add one very brief thing. The rhetoric we have heard from both presidential candidates, to bring it back to that topic, regarding Iran, reflect the importance or perceived importance of one particular group of people right now, and that is Jewish voters in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. So the phrase about "we will not stand by while there's another Holocaust," that phrase is aimed at that electoral strategy. Total disregard of whether Iran has any capability, intentions, other than just the use of political rhetoric to attack Israel.
That's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is the reality of it is that we also, another very important question in terms of American policy in the Middle East is how to reconcile the interest of the United States with the interest of Israel. Mm-hmm. And these two interests are not always the same. Yeah. And it's a hard topic to address, and because of so many different historical reasons. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it's an important issue which ought to be addressed. And the question of Iran is indeed one of those questions at this point, that whether or not what type of situation is ideal for the state of Israel in the region in relation to Iran might not be the ideal situation for the U.S. in the region. Mm-hmm. So at some point we need to address this problem issue, but obviously, as we all know, the presidential election is not the time to address that problem, because we are talking about votes, we are talking about sensitive states like Florida and other places. But hopefully after the election, there'll be time for debating these issues.
Yeah, there has to be a change in the political rhetoric where issues of Israel and its Middle East neighbors are not seen as a zero-sum game. I think the rhetoric now is set up that if you approach any of these complex issues in a way that doesn't maximize the interests of Israel, you're seen as you can be painted in terms of the negative campaigning that happens in these elections, you know, as someone who doesn't understand the situation, not a friend of Israel. The level of rhetoric here prevents any meaningful debate about very, very complex issues. Anything that's here is cannot be really seen as a zero-sum game. It's going to be a matter of compromise within historically embedded complex conflicts and tensions. And sadly, a U.S. presidential debate is not the venue for those things to be explored.
That's right. Let's talk with someone else, someone calling from West Chicago, and this is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. You know, I don't know why we have to interfere with other countries all the time. I'm dead set against buttoning into business, and, you know, maybe this is kind of off-topic in a way, but I resent the fact especially because America is going through a depression right now. We give all these people money, we get nothing in return. I honestly, quite frankly, I'm tired of it. I mean, we actually gave the Japanese the know-how to outproduce us or out-figure us out as far as automobiles. I mean, it seems like everything's coming back to bite us in the butt. And you know, with due respect to your guests and stuff, I think nowadays with dealing with the Middle East, that that's the worst place to go. I quite frankly don't care if they kill each other off or not, because, you know, someday it's going to come back again. And it just seems like it's an occurring thing. And maybe that's me being selfish in this country, but we've dug a hole that's so deep it's going to be very difficult to get out. And one thing we don't need to do is interfere with anybody right now, especially if they're not going to willing to help us out.
Well, I think the caller certainly points at the fact that the issues that have emerged as being the uppermost in the people's minds now in this mm-hmm. presidential race, it's the American economy.
Yes.
You know, at one point, maybe we thought, well, it was mm-hmm. going to be Iraq. Yes, it was going to be more foreign policy. And that has changed. That, of course, the candidates are still – they're still talking about Iraq and they're talking about Iran and they're talking about Pakistan. But – what seems to be most on people's minds is the other sort of issue. So I suppose one question is what, you know, to what extent does foreign policy really end up mattering very much, unless you're talking about perhaps one particular small block of voters mm-hmm. for whom it matters a whole lot. For the electorate as a whole, I'm not sure how much it really does matter this time around.
Well, it's interesting. Most pundits of the American political system would say that foreign policy never matters, rarely matters. And that this was seen to be perhaps an unusual election, that the decision would be the two different stances on this war. But to some degree, that has faded away. And yet, if you think about the most recent presidential debate, it seemed that the most vociferous debate, perhaps, and the, mm-hmm. the way the candidates try to separate mm-hmm. themselves from each other to define their positions was all about mm-hmm. foreign policy mm-hmm. still.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think I'd like to add that foreign policy and domestic issues are not mutually exclusive topics. Mm-hmm. And a lot of issues that we hear about in our involvement, the U.S.'s involvement in Iraq and in different parts of the world, these kind of involvements actually are basically the main incentive behind mm-hmm. these involvements is the national interest of the United States. And mm-hmm. and I think it's a mistake to think that that this kind of engagement with world politics has nothing to do with the everyday lives of Americans. If we understand that 20 to 25% of world energy is passing through the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, you realize that what the U.S. is doing in the region is not really a concern for the people of the region. This is a very important national security and mm-hmm. The national interest of the United States, and that's why really we are there. And in order to control these regions, in order to be a hegemonic power in that region has a lot to do with our national interest. And even the kind of investments that the caller was talking about, we did the U.S. did in Japan, in the rebuilding of Germany. And this is, the world we live in is so interconnected, and it's very hard to draw a line to say that what we do in Japan doesn't have anything to do with our lives mm-hmm. here. And in that sense, mm-hmm. I think we should think of issues of global engagement, international engagement, wars that happens in the world, also in terms of what happens in the domestic economy and everyday bread and butter issues of all Americans. Yeah. So we should not mm-hmm. really think of these two as mutually exclusive topics.
Yeah. The Marshall Plan in Europe post-World War II, the rebuilding of Japan, the common interpretation of those is that those were necessary investments by the United States of America to ensure that it had a global market for its economic strength. It was in a situation post-World War II where its economy had grown immensely because of World War II, but other major economies in Europe and Japan have been literally flattened through the conflict. where was the United States going to sell its goods? And so there was a national interest in that economic engagement. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we're still in that type of relationship of United States global influence across the world. The question is that perhaps in some sense anachronistic now, or certainly in certain places in the world? NATO has had to redefine itself post the Cold War and has tried to redefine itself through these types of conflicts. Bottom line to the caller, I guess, is that what you're asking for is a real major discussion on what the national interest means and really what right we have as a country to be have military presence across the globe. These are major questions, and maybe they will come. I don't think they're going to come in this presidential campaign, and probably not the one after, but I think they are down the road.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left. Just real quick, now there are indications that, well, this is not exactly news, that the situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating, mm-hmm. and that apparently now there's word that a new intelligence finding is going to come out, be made public after the election. But the word is already coming out that that people in the defense establishment are saying, look, this place is about to go off the rails. Mm-hmm. And it's got to have more attention. We're going to have to put more troops into Afghanistan, that we have neglected it at our mm-hmm. peril. Do you think that is in fact the case and that we're in the year to come, we're going to find ourselves, you know, when we talk about foreign policy crisis, we're going to be talking more and more about Afghanistan?
I think it's worse than that because unless we're going to conjure up some troops out of a magic hat, then the troops that are going to will, I think, be reassigned to Afghanistan may well indeed. What does that mean for troop levels in Iraq? And does that include the possibility of sparking conflict in Iraq? I think the two things are related. I think that there is a scenario here, and I stress that it's a scenario rather than something I would put money on, which is not a good idea at this time. In this context, anyway, but the scenario is that this the whole situation, Iraq, Afghanistan. I think Iran can be ameliorated, as Baruch said, but Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, the situation facing an incoming president could be far worse than it currently is.
That's true. I mean, and again, one of the mm-hmm. main problems with Afghanistan's situation was that the invasion happened at the time that Afghanistan was going through another phase of a failed state. And it's always the case that mm-hmm. when you enter a place with an already failed state in place, you're going to be dealing with different regional powers, warlords, drug smugglers, people who are fighting over resources and struggling to have access to these resources for a variety of reasons. And this was the situation in Afghanistan. And again, you know, we are not in a situation to say that we told you so, but nevertheless, we say we told you so that Afghanistan is going to be the major headache for the next president, and of course with what's happening in Pakistan, then you know, we don't want to be in the days of gloom, but this is what we are facing.
There's an overarching issue, I think, a political U.S. political issue overarching these conflicts, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, to a lesser extent, Iran. What is success? What is the deemed result of, quote-unquote, the war on terror? This is something that's never been defined. And because it's never been defined, we don't know what we're meant to be working towards. And therefore, we never really know what we're doing is the right thing to do because we can't figure out what the end result is. This is an overarching political question that will have to be addressed in the next administration. Otherwise, we're going to upset the caller we just had from West Chicago and just get dragged into more and more conflicts. Yeah.
We're trying to squeak one more caller in here. We are very short on time, but we'll try to give them a little time. Mill Creek Valley, Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Really appreciate this in-depth analysis. It agrees with a lot of what I've been thinking. But here's a fact. The United States has been attacked by Islamic militants for about 40 years. Now, and culminating, of course, in 9/11. Now, is it your belief that given the existence of dictatorial regimes and secretive regimes and much poverty, do you think it would have been better to leave the individual countries to try to deal with this themselves? I didn't like the war. I don't like all the military spending and all that. I just want an opinion. Do you think that it would have been better to leave it to the individual countries and just keep taking hits?
What do you think? I can only give you about a minute.
I don't think it's an either or. I don't think all-out invasion on the one hand and do nothing, leave it to other countries on the other hand are the two choices. I think there was the ability to engage in really international lawmaking and international diplomacy to help countries ameliorate and target, militants with inside their borders who had aggressive intent.
I think we're going to have to stop.
I'm sorry.
But what I will say, I'm sure, for people who are listening, is that these issues, we'll be talking about them again in the future on other days with other guests, and particularly right at the moment we're looking for someone to talk about again Afghanistan with. So sometime soon we'll be doing that. And again, as I say, I'm sure these things will not go away. We'll be talking about them for a long time.
I wish they would.
For the moment, we want to say thanks to our guests for this morning. Colin Flint, he's Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Behrouz Ghamari, he is Assistant Professor of History and Sociology. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.